I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Between Happy New Year and the State of the Union, you can write your own take on 2018, and it's as valid as anybody's. The stand-up wise man economist Mark Blythe is our model of using the vernacular incisively, with laugh lines as needed, to see where we are. 2017 proved that the world can still turn without grown-ups running anything in America. Year two could be pushing our luck. The theme seems to be waiting for Russiagate to play out, for millennials to show up in force, for the Clintons to retire, which Mark Blythe says they won't. And what about the Trump brand as the business climate brightens? Mark Blythe is a people watcher from Scotland, an expert at the junction of money and power, a popular professor at Brown University. As soon as he starts talking, what you'll hear is a working-class mind with a strong public education, the son of a butcher in Dundee in northeast Scotland. Mark Blythe always makes me feel we're in a raucous pub in Glasgow when suddenly a noisy native with a stand-up comedy touch gets up to straighten us out about pretty much everything. First question from a pub crowd, I said to Professor Blythe at Brown this week, had to be, how can that clumsy, unpopular president be written off as a universal menace when his job market, which these people really care about more than the stock market, is booming? How can that be?
So what's happened is, after an incredibly long recession, particularly in Europe, you've got a cyclical turn-up in the economy, because things don't stay down forever. Assets get cheap. People start to buy them again. Programs like quantitative easing, which are very distortionary, nonetheless actually produce results in the sense that interest rates get low, animal spirits are activated, and job markets begin to heal. All of this stuff is going to happen anyway. Trump came along just as he did for his coalition. He came along at the right time, found a coalition, talked a big game, and the markets turned at the same point in time.
Go back 8 years in another way. Fashionable opinion would be telling President Obama, if he were doing it again, work on the job thing. Put health care and all that other fancy stuff later. Work on jobs. Trump seems to have got that result, no?
Well, he just walked into the result. I mean, let's go back to Obama in the middle of a financial crisis, where he's been told, if you don't bail out the global banking system, there'll be armed riots in the streets and no food in the shops. That was what was being said at the time. Hence, we had to bail all the things that shouldn't have been bailed. So faced with that, how do you do jobs? You don't do jobs. You triage the banking system, which is what he did. And once you stop the hemorrhaging and you can put Bo Simpson to one side, you focus on healthcare, because that's a long-term policy goal. So he wouldn't have done it any different. Trump has walked into his coalition and embraced it. Trump has walked into a good economy and taken credit for it. It's that simple.
Let me ask the pubster's question a different way. How can the business class be feeling so crazy bullish about this deregulated economy and the rest of us feeling a kind of cosmic doom coming? Robots, deficit crisis, debt crisis, over-liquidity crisis, a political substance crisis. Nobody's talking seriously about anything anymore. How do these things coexist?
Well, they coexist because most of the time politics doesn't matter. I mean, if you're in a cyclical upswing and the economy is doing well and labor markets are fine, you can have a little more credit growth. You get a tiny little bit of wage growth. Inflation's low, so basically creditors are getting paid back and it's easy to service your debt because interest rates are low. So you can reflate the system, reliquidate the system and keep it going. And that's what's happened. And for the majority of people, they're actually not feeling existential crisis, right? Maybe people on radio shows in very liberal states are, but a huge number of people in this country aren't. Think about the guy's numbers. The guy's numbers still don't drop below 30%, right? That means one third of the country isn't really bothered at all, minimum. Right. So existential crisis. Let's think about AI. AI is going to take all of our jobs. Right. There's a McKinsey Institute research paper that came out recently that interviewed, I think it was 3,200 senior C-level, as they call them, high executives that are using or are thinking of using AI stuff. 80% of them expect to add more labor because of AI rather than less. Let me give you an example from Rhode Island. There's a buddy of mine who runs a prosciutto factory here in Rhode Island, right? Now, he basically persuades the family business to stop one of the most horrible jobs in the world, which is moving prosciutto around as a physical task. So imagine your job was this. Every day you get up, you walk up a ladder, you pick up a big pork leg, right? And you have to hook it off, walk down a ladder, walk along a floor, move up another ladder, stick it on top again. How long do you think your back would last? Nobody should be doing that job, right? So what did he do? He replaced everybody who was doing that job with robots. Guess what happens now? Hmm. His productivity has increased so much, he went from employing 200 people to 600 people. We tell ourselves these doom and disaster stories. There's something about, particularly the liberal left in the United States, that any type of change is a mortal threat. Now, I don't want to underplay Trump, his stupidity, his angst, the racism of politics of the moment. But really, take a step back. We had the whole of last year. We were all terrified. Nobody died. Right? We were fine. The whole world is not in flames.
Mark, what makes you so interesting for me as a political economist, touching both of those elements, is that you think about it the way we do, with much more expertise, but as a sort of social narrative. For years, you told us that Europe, maybe the U.S. too, didn't have an economic crisis. It had a banking crisis. But that's one of many. We have, it seems, an equality crisis. We have a political crisis. We may have an existential crisis, as you say. People think we've got a social hatred and inequality crisis on our hands. Which ones are the real ones? And which ones are versions of each other?
For something to be a crisis, it needs to be felt as a crisis. And it certainly felt for some people. And if you go on Twitter and look for hashtags on certain things, you'll find there are crises everywhere. There's a crisis of every flavour you could possibly want breaking out all over. We have, since the advent of cable news, a 24-hour news cycle. So everything has to be reported all the time and hyped up all the time because everything's really important all the time. Breaking now, exactly the same thing that happened an hour ago, right? Everyone's on edge all the time about everything. Now, has politics fundamentally changed because of Trump? No, politics fundamentally changed because the people in charge basically ignored millions of Americans and what was happening to their standard of living, their communities, what was happening to their life chances and opportunities, and basically lived on the coast and said to each other, gee, isn't everything swell? And they got really surprised when about 40 million of them said, actually, no, it isn't. We don't like what you're doing. And this is a global result that's happened in lots and lots of countries. There's a left-wing result of this, a right-wing version of this. I wrote about it. It's called Global Trumpism. You can go from the Philippines to Japan to Scotland to America. Guess what? They're all self-declared nationalists.
And you anticipated it.
But my point is this. You're looking at the symptoms, not at the causes. You're looking at Twitter feeds as information. They're not. They're perspiration. They're sweat. They're angst. There's no information there. The real causes are a 30-year shift in the way that the global economy works. That essentially we went from a kind of national version of capitalism with restricted financial markets where full employment and domestic welfare were held to be the goals of the state to a world in which inflation became the mortal threat, central banks became the governors, and finance was allowed to do whatever it did.
We've heard this story before, but you tell it better than anybody. 45 to 75, the post-war bargain, strong unions, reasonably strong social services. Take us through it, and then what happened?
So think about it. You come out of the trauma of World War II and the Great Depression. One of the things I always do in talks, I say, have many of you got grandparents that lived through the Great Depression? A few people put their hand up and say, did they ever have, or if they're still alive, do they have dried goods and beans in the basement? And they all say yes. Now, the US trauma didn't involve civil war, Nazis, and genocide, but it did in Europe. So coming out of that trauma, governments everywhere, left and right, said, right, one thing, full employment. That has to be the policy goal. We can't go back to that. Now, how do you make a full employment economy? Well, it's pretty simple. You stop capital exiting to find the highest return. You give it tax sweeteners to make sure it invests at home. You get a really high rate of investment going. That creates high productivity, which allows you to pay higher wages. And firms innovate to pay the wages. And that continues as a virtuous circle. And it worked everywhere. It trebled French national income between 1950 and 1970. The Italians called it il boom over the same period. And that was the general story. Now, it had a weakness. The weakness is, once you've got inflation in the system, which has to happen when you've got super tight labour markets, and there's a whole story about the dollar's international use, but the domestic story is the key one. Once you've got super tight labour markets for 30 years, the dumbest guy in your firm can leave that firm, walk into another job and demand a higher wage. Eventually, you can't keep up with that with productivity. You have to pay more for less. You start to generate inflation. Once you generate inflation, the rate of profitability goes down. It becomes irrational to invest. You get stagflation, simultaneous existence of unemployment, and yet at the same time, inflation. The system gets a reset. The reset was called Thatcher, Reagan. It was the reset in economic thinking around the time. And what this leads to is a whole new system reset where inflation's the policy target, finance is allowed to do whatever it can to find the highest rate of return, and you end up in a credit-induced rip that goes around the globe.
Go back to the end of the Golden Age. I mean, it came to that rather hapless figure of Gerald Ford with his win button, whip inflation now. Why didn't the powers whip inflation, and or could they have, to save the
golden
goose?
Well, we did whip inflation. Paul Volcker basically jacked up interest rates to 20%. The rates on T-bills went up to 16%, and the economy hemorrhaged. And that was the Reagan recession. In the 70s, it was a weird period, right? Because what it meant was interest rates, real interest rates were negative. What does that mean? The inflation rate's higher than the interest rate. So if you hold debt, somebody else is paying the debt. Why have boomers got such big houses? Because they took out a 30-year bond with a 4% coupon on it, and inflation went to 10%. So over 10 years, half the debt was eaten by the bank. How do you think the banking sector felt about that? Right. So what happens is you get a system reset. Then you get to the 1980s, you have historically high real interest rates. Why? Because inflation falls much, much faster than interest rates. So you're getting a premium for being in finance. All the money flows into finance. Welcome to the generation of inequality.
It didn't flow by itself. I mean,
no, actually, it meant in large part it did.
Really?
Because I love this vision of finance whereby a bunch of people who were 26 years old in 1977 somehow strategized that they would take over the world and by 2007 cause a global financial crisis where they would get bailed out. I don't know about you. I find it hard to strategize the weekend, right? Just to get that far,
yeah,
you know?
Things work out. You have an academic friend. It sounded a lot like me, actually. People who had middle-class careers, paid their mortgages, and now own what's tremendously valuable real estate that their kids couldn't begin to dream of owning.
Right.
How did this happen?
Well, it happened in part because you had the 1980s, where you had historically unprecedented high real interest rates, and the people who were the hippies in the 60s accumulated assets with debt in the 70s and decided to kill the inflation to lock in the real value of those assets in the 80s. So you elect Reagan, and you get high interest rates all the way through. So you're getting 8% real for showing up at a checking account in Chemical Bank in New York, and then you get a mortgage out of that time, and the interest rate continues to fall, and inflation rates continue to fall,
right.
So you build up more and more assets over the life cycle because growth is actually high in real terms. And just by showing up and being on the right side of the baby boomer curve, by the time you're 60, you have pretty much everything.
True.
It's not difficult.
That's political economist Mark Blythe at Brown University's Watson Institute. Coming up, the Blythe case for blaming the boomers as they head off into their Florida sunset. This is Open Source. We're getting Mark Blythe's natural history of the present moment in what he calls anecdata. The story lurches into a sullen mood on people's discovery in the new century that their debts have gone high, their wages too low to cover them, and inflation has been cut so that it no longer keeps reducing the value of what they owe. What happened, I asked him, to the people's protections and their leaders through that post-war golden age?
I hate the term the golden age because it wasn't golden for African Americans. It wasn't golden for women, right? It was golden for basically the white working classes. And it was Macmillan who said, you've never had it so good in 1963. And it's absolutely true. But Valium prescriptions for women stuck at home had never been higher because they were excluded from the labor market.
Mm-hmm.
So let's be careful about what we're saying is the golden age here, right? And the simplest way to understand it is from 45 to 70, the top of the income distribution went down. The bottom went up massively. And the whole distribution jumped up. So the whole society as a whole became richer. So even if you were losing at the very top, the whole society was gaining. What began to happen in the 1980s was the top tail just moved away. That's your 1%. They just took it. That's what happened. And it happened because if you were rich enough and able enough to capture financial gains in the 80s and continue to basically hold and trade those assets through the life cycle, you will make a ton of money. Why do you think Florida is filled with rich old people? I know, I was just in Naples. I was one of the youngest people there. Loads of healthcare. Healthcare in strip malls everywhere. Wonder why, because they're all old.
Track the populist reaction in this country and in the world. We're still in the thick of it.
Yeah, you're still in the thick of it. So the narrative out of Brussels, once the economy turned, was, look, only 25% of Dutch people voted for a guy who looked like a fake James Bond villain. That being Geert Wilders. And then the Le Pen family business didn't make it. In part because they have two rounds of voting and because the rest of the ticket was split. Macron won the election, but then when you looked at the deputies' vote for like his people going into parliament, lowest turnout ever. Merkel wins. She still can't form a government. Ooh. The Czech Republic, billionaire populist, their version of Trump. And then AfD, Alternative for Deutschland. They're a nasty bunch of folks. They're now 12% of the German parliament. So it's definitely still there. Now, why is it? Well, let's go back to that story I've been telling for the past year. things are 30 years in the making. If you've had 30 years of wage stagnation for 80% of the population and they've been living off of credit and the creditors want their money back, they're going to get pissed. If the cost of the things that really matter in life, education, over 100% increase since 1990, higher education, 150% increase, right? Healthcare, around 80 to 100% increase. Meanwhile, all the elites are telling you, but don't worry, core inflation's low and your wages aren't going to go up. You're going to get pissed. Now, at the end of the day, somebody comes along, and this could take the form of Trump, this could take the form of a left populist, right? This could be the guy who runs the M5, the five-star movement in Italy, who's got the biggest single potential vote share in the elections that are coming up, Beppe Grillo, who's on the left. And what these guys do is they just call everyone else a bullshitter. Now, they're bullshitters themselves, but what they do is they basically come in and say, hey, look, you know what? Healthcare's gone up 80% in the US, and your wages haven't gone up. Bit of a problem, eh? So there's the Bernie Sanders version of that. Here's the Trump one. You know what took your job away? Chinese competition. Now, he's not wrong in the following sense. Lots of American firms moved from America, went to China, and then re-import here. So it's actually American firms that are largely to blame for this.
Right.
But there's a huge trade effect. Go to David Otter's wonderful site, China Shock. Right, look it up on Google, and you can go community to community on basically how much the impact of Chinese trade has been on the local economy. Right, it's huge. Right, So there's been real negative effects. Meanwhile, our elites, right, whether it's Tony Blair, whether it's the Clintons, whatever, has been saying everything's great, the new global economy, we're all doing fabulous. Well, you're all doing fabulous because you only talk to each other, you only live in half a dozen places, and you all earn tons of cash. So, of course, and you travel internationally, everybody's like you. You're not a nationalist. You don't have a national or local identity. Identity, you're rich enough to be a global cosmopolitan. You can enjoy all of the fruits of globalization, but not everybody else can. So it's self-explanatory.
Imagine the future course of this beast, this populist engine.
So people say to me, here's the thing about your theory that it's all about things like healthcare and education becoming expensive. What about in Europe? They have big welfare states and they still have populace, right? And here's the thing, right across the world, again, it's aging. There's a huge amount of social expenditure in Europe. Even in Britain, which is a crappy welfare state, vast majority of it goes on pensions. Why? Because there are more and more old people. They're the one that have the assets, but they also in Europe have quasi-universal systems where they get up to 80% of their last wage replaced as their final pension. Hugely expensive. Now, at the same time, they've been cutting taxes, so they've got a revenue problem. They went through a financial crisis. They've now got more debt, even though interest rates on the debt are very low. Don't forget that. So they've got lots and lots of people basically withdrawing cash from the state. You've got less and less people coming in because we have less kids and also because we don't like immigrants. So you have a long-term massive fiscal problem. Look at the numbers spent on the stuff that would actually make a difference. That's what's been getting cut because you can't cut pensions. Why? Because everywhere in this world, pensioners vote two times as much as everybody else. They all show up. They all live in a fixed income. They hate inflation and they want theirs.
Do you want to imagine the consequences of the tax cut? This incredible bill on which there were no hearings and which the Republicans have made an unbelievably risky bet, seems to me. What's going to happen?
I think it's a rounding error. It doesn't make any difference.
Really?
No, here's the story. So go back to the financial crisis. The U.S. economy at the turn of the financial crisis was, I think, about $15 trillion, right? And it went from 60% debt to GDP to 100%. And then it grew to $17 trillion by the time it did that. So you got $17 trillion in debt. Well, it's going down now because the economy is growing. It's about 90% of GDP, and the economy is now up again to about $18 trillion. So let's kick it forward 10 years. You're talking about a $26 trillion economy. And let's say that miraculously growth sustains itself. There's no massive recession. There will be, but just presume there's not, right? Then just on those dynamics alone, quick back of the head calculation, your debt to GDP ratio would probably fall about 70% just by the dynamics of growth. Let's assume there's a temporary spurt of growth extra because of the tax cuts, but it peters out over time. So you've added $1.5 trillion to the debt, but it's going down because of growth dynamics, and it's now $25 or $26 trillion. So you've got less debt rather than more. What's the problem? There isn't one. All the stuff about massive fiscal irresponsibility, I've been telling you this for years in the austerity book and everywhere else. If you are the United States, if you get to print the global reserve asset, if you get to print the bit of paper that everybody else has to earn in order to conduct foreign trade, if you get to offer T-bills, there's never been a T-bill sale that's failed. China, that doesn't want to hold them anymore, reduced its holdings from $3 trillion to $1.5 trillion. They're back up to 3.1 because there's nothing else to buy, because we won't sell them guns, pharma, and tech. And they keep selling us stuff in Walmart, so they keep getting dollars. So they buy more T-bills, which produces low interest rates here, which allows us to go to Walmart and go, Jesus, did I just get a TV for $500? Yes, you did. Welcome to globalization. That's the mechanism. That's what makes it all work. All this accountancy nonsense, it's a huge number. Well, it's a huge number. It's a huge economy. So, yeah, should they have done this tax cut? No. If we can afford to spend $100.5 billion, we shouldn't be giving it away to rich people. We should be investing it in schools and infrastructure, all the stuff we know we should be doing. We've got the UN walking around the United States just now worrying about urban and rural poverty.
Yeah, thank you.
Right? We should not be in this state. We're cutting back every aspect of Obamacare, which is basically saying to 5 million people, you're going to die early because we don't want to pay for anything. This is disgusting. This is disgraceful. We should not be doing this tax cut. But really, if you follow the, oh, it's the debt, the terrible debt, right? You're playing into the hands of people like the Peterson Foundation, who politicize the stuff, the debt clock, all this sort of stuff. Because it's basically the 1% doesn't want to pay a wealth tax, right? At the end of the day, that's it. So they want everything cut now so that the deficits and debts are reduced. So when it does become critical, they're not asked to pay for anything. That's all this is.
Mark, I'm fascinated that you're putting more and more premium in your full maturity now on the role of leadership, personal, charismatic, serious, persistent human leadership. Where is it and where do you look for it?
Really good of you to notice this. This is absolutely true. Now, part of this is an age thing, right? So I'm now at the age where I run things and everybody I know runs things. So you can't just basically go, oh, somebody else is going to fix this, right? You basically are aware of who's running stuff and you begin to realize how much is badly run. I mean, how many things that we take for granted are just run by Muppets? Right, so you begin to recognize a non-Muppet when you see one and go, wow, that's actually amazing. So leadership's important. But at the same time, the story that I tell about Trump is he hasn't blown up the world yet. Doesn't mean he won't blow it up in 2018. I have reasons for doubting that. We can get into it. You've got strong institutions. You've got the Mueller investigation. You've got the fact that South Korea doesn't want to die in a nuclear war. There's lots of things going on there, right? But nonetheless, the quality of leadership matters. Now, here's a little anecdote. I was at a big finance conference in 2017, and it's like serious money in the room, hedge funds, endowments, university endowments, all this sort of stuff. And I said to them, look, let me ask you a question. How many of you fund political campaigns and politicians? Every hand. Not the university foundations. They're not allowed to do this, right? And if you think about it, this is something that the top 20%, but really the top 1% of America does. That's where all the money comes from for politics, right? And I said, how many of you would allow any of the people that you give money to their campaigns to run money in your company? And the whole room collapsed in laughter. And I said, no, stop laughing. That's not funny. Because if I'd asked that question 30 years ago, a lot of you would have said, yeah, absolutely. Because there was a quality to what you might call the political capital of the political class, right? These days, they're a bunch of ambulance chasers who take on public service to figure out what they can learn so they can go sell it to the private sector, working as a consultant or work running a foundation or whatever it is. Tenure of congressman, down. Expertise of congressman, down. Right? Bunch of partisan hacks and ideologues. Now, that's why they won't let them run their money, but they'll fund their campaigns. That seems to be an incredible disconnect and an incredibly dangerous phenomenon. Right across the world, the quality of political leadership, I think, has collapsed. And that's why people are listening to nationalist populists and leftist populists, because at least there's an authenticity and a clarity and a resolution to what they're saying, as opposed to, oh, I don't know, what do you want this week? Like Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio's a man of principle. He is going to say that I'm not going to vote for the tax cuts unless the child credit goes back in. What happened to that one? Folded in a minute, right? It's the same story everywhere. So I truly despair of the let's say, the credit quality of the political classes.
I wonder why. I wonder how this happened. I mean, people have been lamenting the boomers as public people for a long time. The Clinton cycle seems to have finally been exhausted.
No, she's going to run again.
You think no?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
she
definitely.
Told you?
No. But it makes sense.
Tony Blair going to run for prime minister again? I don't think so.
Okay, let me run a scenario past you. All right. So what's the very first thing that Senator Clinton does the day she's defeated?
She writes a book.
No. She sets up a network of activists that is designed to get more women into office. Apparently, it's quite successful. I forget the name of it. But you've now got a separate email list from the DNC and a bunch of foot soldiers the day after. What's the next thing you do? You get Tom Perez to come back and run the DNC, and you start a not-too-quiet purge of all Bernie supporters. Number three, you got the Donna Brazil book comes out that basically says that the DNC was run by Clinton money for the Clintons. So they run the finances of the organization that's going to choose the nominator. Number four, you write the book. The book is completely self-exculpatory and attacks the one guy who was the main threat to you and remains the main threat to you, even though he went out and campaigned for you. Number four, you begin the apology tour. You go to all the places you didn't do before. You do some more public speaking. You tell people you're listening, et cetera, et cetera. 6 months from now, you get the exploratory committee. Why do you get the exploratory committee? Because if I have all that and I've killed everybody else, I've got the Cersei Lannister problem. No one else can rule Westeros because I've killed them all. So it has to be me. I'm back.
More like what I see Biden doing.
Biden's 105 years old.
Well, but where there's death, there's hope, as the man said, right?
Well, society does evolve one funeral at a time. That's certainly true. And there are actually now more millennials than there are boomers. But the problem is, as I said before, boomers vote twice as much. And let me give you some wonderful statistics on this. 80% of all financial assets in this country are owned by baby boomers. But that's misleading because even though that's a huge concentration because they're just one part of the population, the top 20% of boomers own 80% of that 80%, which means that 64% of everything is owned by the richest boomers in the country, right? That's your real 1% or concentration, 1% to 5%. That's basically everything, right? So they've got everything. Who do you think they're going to vote for? I think there's a lot of Bernie Sanders support in that one.
They'll vote for Hillary. You're right about that. But what's wrong with the boomers, Mark?
Everything.
Begin at the beginning.
So imagine it's 1968. You get to go to the University of California, Berkeley, for a couple of $100 a quarter. You get the greatest minds of the post-World War II generation, which have fled Europe and made home in California. You get to live in the summer of love before there's AIDS or even herpes to live about. You get to be a hippie. And then in the 70s, you have to get real. So you start to accumulate assets. There's a lot of inflation. It means your nominal wage is going up, your real wage is going down. But if you buy debt instruments, it means that the holder of the credit, the creditor on the other side, is eating at cause of inflation. So hence, boomers have big houses, as we said before, right? So then you get to the 1980s. And then the 1980s, you'd say, oh, this is too much. We've got to change it up. So along comes Reagan, a guy who was totally wrong in the 70s and totally right by the 80s. The whole world moved to his preferences. It's a brilliant book on this called The Invisible Bridge by Perelstein.
Yeah, Rick Perelstein,
fantastic,
indeed.
Fantastic book. And what he just shows is how you go to 1969, like Reagan was this freak, this weirdo who was concerned with stuff that nobody gave a damn about. And then the 70s were such a crazy decade that by the time that you get there, basically everyone's come to him and his preferences. So you get the reset. You get Thatcher's the same thing. So you basically stop worrying about full employment. It's all about inflation control. You got to cut down public spending. You go to war with the unions. You do all this sort of stuff. You liberalize, you globalize, you integrate, you privatize. That's the mantra. And basically you start to get this huge set of returns going to the top 20%, particularly the 1%. But that's boomers because by that point they're in their 40s. And they're the people who are voting for this because they've got assets. They don't want to have high inflation eating away their savings anymore. They want to lock in those real interest rates. So they do. They ride this out all the way. And you have this bull market that goes from 1987 in stocks all the way to 2007. You've got a 401k. Fantastic. Now, Trump was out the other day going, look at the stock market, 401k, everybody's doing great. Last time I checked the numbers, only 22% of American firms offer 401ks. And half of all 401ks have no money in them. So once again, what that means is, on average, Americans have, I think, $36,000 in the 401k. No, it means a whole bunch of people, like 10%, have $360,000, and a huge amount of people have absolutely nothing and are barely, they've got Social Security and that's it. And guess what? Ryan, that piece of Ryan, is already, as you know, this is the danger of the tax cuts, right? We do the tax cuts, we'll have a deficit. Look at that deficit. We need to cut Social Security. That man's so ridiculous. But anyway, to go back, continuing with the boomers. By the time you get to the 1990s, they're in their 50s. They've paid off their mortgages. They can sort of send their kids to college because college tuition hasn't gone through the roof yet. What's there not to like? They vote for Bill. They vote for Hillary. It's great. Then you get to 2007. Boom, the whole world goes down. Guess who you've got to bail out? You've got to bail out the banks. Why have you got to bail out the banks? Well, Here's the thing about banks. Assets and liabilities for a bank are different from you and me. My asset is my condo in Boston. That's the bank's liability because they don't want to own a condo. They want the income from the mortgage. So their asset is my liability, vice versa, and it all sums to zero. When you look at it that way, when you bail the banks, you're bailing out the assets and incomes of the top 20%, which would be particularly the top 20% of boomers, which would be particularly those who own 64% of everything. So they're not awful in the sense that they're awful people. They're just following the incentives that have been laid out to them in a free market system to accumulate as much assets as possible and leave it to their kids, which means they hate inheritance taxes, they want to pay low marginal rates, and they continually vote down things like bonds for schools, bonds for subways, Boston, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, they're acting in a completely understandable way, which for them is individually rational, but it's just really crap for everybody else who come in behind them who can't accumulate assets in the same way, precisely because they've done that.
That's the boomers, and we think their day is over. Talk about...
Oh, no, they're around for a long time.
You think?
You want to make a lot of money over the next 15 years, it's dead easy. Build a portfolio entirely around healthcare and big pharma, because the boomers that have the money intend to live forever, and they will spend all the money they can and still leave a boatload of cash to their kids, drawing down not just Social Security, but huge amounts of healthcare, which is why this country is scheduled to go to 20% of GDP on healthcare when everybody else in the OECD is under 10%.
Aren't they going to go to Cuba and get it much cheaper with better music?
No, they're not inventive enough to do that. Come on.
Coming up, what the Trump voters are still unhappy about, and what, if anything, could disarm them. This is Open Source. With Mark Blythe at Brown University, listen for a bit of the backstory that gives him a certain sympathy with Trump voters. It's the sort of thing he shares on the road with his friend, another cult commentator beyond category, the writer-financier who gave us the Black Swan, Nassim Nicholas Taleb.
My wonderful friend Nassim Taleb has a wonderful version of this story, which we kind of hatched together in Ireland a wee while ago when all this happened. And it comes from his observation, why do we eat McDonald's when we drive around in preference to other food like Taco Hell or Dead Lobster? Because it's very, very hard to get a bad McDonald's. And they're cheap and they're consistent. And they're great, but as Morgan Spurlock showed us, if you eat them for a year, really bad stuff happens, right? Now, let's think about this in the point of view of Trump voters. So you live in the part of the country where you don't get private equity investment. You live in the part of the country where there are massive potholes, where you've got Republicans cutting taxes all the time and handing back money at the top 20%, which means that your schools are total crap, right? You have more and more social problems. There's a thing to look at called the Distress Communities Index. Wonderful thing that takes into account everything from unemployment to opioid addiction to healthcare access, etc. And the sheer number of stressed communities across the United States is mind-boggling. And guess where a lot of them were? In Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, yep. Which became the blue states that flipped for Trump, right? Now, basically, imagine the following.
A lot of them had family members that served in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, absolutely. The other 1%. Absolutely, right? Do liberal elites do that? Very, very few. Do conservative elites do that? Very, very few. It's these folks that are doing it, right? Now, you've got this situation where over the past 24 years, people have come in every 4 years, they fly into your flyover state, and they say to you, vote for me, jobs, vote for me, hope, vote for me, change. And things don't change. They actually get worse. So after a while, you begin to figure out, doesn't matter, Democrat, Republican, you're a liar. You're just a liar. Now, along comes the next liar. There's no upside in voting for a liar. They're a liar. Along comes Trump. Trump's a bullshit artist. Now, there's potentially an upside with a bullshit artist. He might actually pull this off. He's at least talking your language. He at least recognizes who you are. He doesn't patronize you. He doesn't say things like, as a White House economist once did during the Obama administration, but iPads are getting cheaper. Yeah, that really makes a difference to the family holding it together, doesn't it? So anyway, they don't patronize in this way. He comes in, basically talks your language. And what he's basically saying is, you guys, they've been feeding you McDonald's for the longest time. Look at you. Look what happens when you eat McDonald's for 24 years. Have you seen the coasts? They're bathing in lobster. They're rubbing foie gras on themselves and laughing at you. That's an incredibly powerful narrative. Now, regardless of the truth content of the narrative, right, once you hit onto that, you have created a constituency which is yours, because what you've then got is a form of schadenfreude politics. See, it doesn't really matter if Trump makes things better, because things for me suck as they are. But if they make things worse for those guys, I'm going to enjoy that. So what happened in the tax cut? Lots of blue states got a bit more expensive. because we can't write off state and local taxes anymore. We can't deduct up to $1.2 million in interest on our mortgages anymore. So all those liberals that have said, I think people should pay more taxes, guess what? Now's your chance. Now, I didn't want to be the guy who paid more taxes so I could write a very big check to my favorite rich person and hand it to them as an extra bonus, to paraphrase Barbara Ehrenreich on the tax cut. And that's what's happened. But you can imagine there's a certain amount of schadenfreude in this one. You want a tax reform? Watch this. I'm going to give it to my guys. I'm not going to give it to the people who voted for me. In fact, I'm going to screw them even more. But here's the payoff for them. I get to screw you, and they hate you.
At a time when people love to imagine that things are all falling apart for a million reasons, identify some of the things that are not a problem. Maybe immigration, maybe identity politics, maybe maybe racism, maybe human evil. What are not the crises we ought to worry about?
Look, everything you just identified is a real problem. And politics over the past 2 years has really brought this to the fore. The United States is a racialized polity. Its politics have always been that way from the Southern strategy onwards. The fact that the Trump campaign wasn't dog whistling, it was walking around with a pack of dogs that were whistling. Right? There's no doubt that racism has increased. There's no doubt that the alt-right movement and basically citizens, militias wandering around with guns shouting about death to Jews and socialists. Yeah, it's pretty scary stuff, right? But there's a bit of show and tell in all this. How many of those people actually are there? How many of them, when you go to Charlottesville and kill one person, absolutely tragic that this happened, I'm not downplaying that at all, but they kill one person, there's a couple of hundred of them. They're outnumbered by the news media who are following them around. We're turning this into this sensationalized panic, this proto-civil war across the country, which actually most people don't see and aren't involved in. You've got elites screaming at each other about, it's all racism, it's this, no, look at the terrible gender politics. All that's absolutely true. But the vast majority of people in this country, look at the surveys, don't really care about those issues. They don't. Particularly if you look at Republican voters. There was one that came out a couple of weeks ago. No Republican men, according to the survey, are talking to their families about Me Too or sexual harassment. None. That's half the country. So all those things are real. And there's a kind of politics of distraction with this being real. And here's what I mean by that. The Trump administration just managed to give their mates $1.5 trillion out of the public purse because we are correctly focused on cultural, social, and identity issues, which are real and affect the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. And the price of us focusing our anger there is they, in the middle of the night, stole $1.5 trillion. That's what's going on. So there's loads of stuff that's wrong, but the more we focus on this stuff that's over here and fight amongst ourselves, which is what the liberal elites are doing, the more they walk off with more and more and more and undermine more of our capacity to intervene in the economy, undermine more of the capacity of the state to produce any public goods whatsoever. That's their game. Bannon says this all the time. I love identity politics because the left just rips its own face off over it, and I win every time. And he's absolutely right.
Mark Blythe, what's the agenda for 2018? I'm talking economics, politics, but also us, the conversational agenda.
I have no idea. The same as in 2017. We simply don't know. So the big ones are this. Are we all going to die in a nuclear war because of North Korea? It might happen. You know, it's kind of unpriceable risk. But you've got certain factors that would stop this. Number one, Japan doesn't want to have another nuclear bomb go off in its territory. They're kind of important. Neither does South Korea. Very much doubt that North Korea, who are playing a very strategic game here, piss off the US, piss off the US, then get concessions elsewhere. They're actually not going to go anywhere with us. Do they really want to threaten us with a nuke? Yeah. Are they ever going to fire a nuke? No, we turn them into a car park. It's ridiculous. So there are strong structural reasons as to why I don't think that's really going to kick off. But you don't know. Trump could be completely mad, right? Well, maybe. I don't know. I'm not a psychologist, etc. I don't know how you actually fire nukes. People are worried about this. It's a threat. Tail risk. It's out there in the tail. I can't price it. I don't know. Whatever else. Let's see. Bitcoin. We didn't talk about that. That's a good one. If you got in early, fantastic. God love you. But what you've got is a $400 million asset class where essentially Chinese gamblers, smugglers, and rich people who used to invest in unicorns in Silicon Valley but got bored with that have decided to buy a prestige asset. The more of them that buy it, because it's in limited supply, the more the price goes up. And it goes up and up and up. And it's incredibly volatile. So here's my line on Bitcoin. Is it money? Number one, if you have to explain to someone that it's money, money? It's not money. Number two, is it a store of value? No, it's too volatile. Is it a unit of exchange? No, because everybody's hoarding it because they expect the value to go up, right? Is it a unit of account? Well, maybe if you're like living in a basement and read the X-Files all the time, but normal people use dollars. So this is a bunch of rich people buying and selling stuff. That's all it is. But what about blockchain, the technology behind it? I've been hearing this for 10 years. I'm waiting to see the results, and it'll still be the same in 2018.
You barely mentioned China, even among the people who don't want a nuclear war in Korea.
Right, so they also have a strong interest in not having a nuclear war in Korea. Let's imagine that it all goes pear-shaped. It turns out that Trump is mental. Kim Il-Twinkie's drunk. They decide to fire a missile at San Francisco. It gets through. The United States does full retaliation. What's the incentive for the Chinese to lob their 100 missiles at the US, even if this happens, given redundant second strike capacity? Zero. As for China itself, it's going to continue to tick along, growing at about 6%, with a banking system we barely understand, levered up the wazoo, sitting on an enormous war chest, trillions and trillions of dollars in the form of T-bills and other assets. It's decided that since we won't sell them real stuff, they'll make their own. It's called the One Belt, One Road project. They've got $47 billion building port facilities in Pakistan, similar amount in Djibouti. They're building infrastructure and railroads all over the peninsula, down in Indonesia. So they're basically taking the core of the global economy from Europe and the United States, all old, by the way, growing slowly because old people save too much, they've already bought the fridge, to places with much better demography. China's not one of them, but the rest of the neighborhood has. And they're basically, you know, going to move the global economy over there. The one other thing I think is incredibly important is if you look at India and you look at China, the air quality is terrible. Doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. You can't escape this one. You can't do the Matt Damon film where you go live in a space station. If you're rich, that one's not there. So these countries have an enormous incentive to clean up their environment. The way that China got rich was basically comparative advantage in cheap labor and environmental despoilation. Their wages are rising and they can't spoil the environment anymore, so they're changing the growth model. They want to be much more consumption-oriented, hence One Belt, One Road, all the rest of it. What that means is we're behind the curve on where they want to be in terms of exports. They don't want to export us anymore in volume. They want to import and grow their own economy. So they're already there. That's what One Belt, One Road's about. So like Trump's jumping around going, unfair Chinese trade. It's like, look, there are American firms in China selling to Walmart, right? This is not exactly Chinese trade. Try and figure this stuff out, right? But the longer point is this. When you've got a huge incentive to clean up your environment and you have these semi-authoritarian regimes, they will. China installed in 2015 and 2016 more solar than the United States has. One of the consequences of the United States turning away from climate change is actually progressive climate change. Here's why. Everybody sits around waiting for the Americans to do stuff. So we come and we sign on. Everyone goes, great, we've done stuff. You haven't done crap. Then you got to get 50 states to do it. Then you got to get the Senate to ratify it. And there's always going to be opposition given the power of coal and oil and other industries here. So what happens is you've got countries like China, which are actually growing, that are incredibly polluted. And they look around and they say, we have to do something about this. So then they look at the Germans. And the Germans have been doing over the past 10 years called the Energiewende, the energy shift. They're shutting down nuclear. Some of the states and some of the cities in Germany can generate at certain points 30% of their power needs just from renewables. They've got countries like Siemens, BASF, all the big conglomerates that are engineering. They've got the best engineering in the world. And they're basically making the green tech, the windmills, the solar, the next generation solar products, the renewable tech. They're licensing it to the Chinese. The Chinese are putting it up to scale, putting it out there, and then they're getting a cutback. So they're doing the technical fix that is the only real thing that makes a difference. Because we can have as many Copenhagen meetings and champagne toasts as we want, but unless you start doing something about climate change, nothing happens. Now, having the Americans on board is great, but we talk a good game, but we don't do very much. And the ones that do, like California, are going to continue to do that anyway. So Trump telling the rest of the world we're not playing actually produces the rest of the world going, you know what, we need to get together and do it ourselves.
How is it you make so much sense that even our great Paul Krugman doesn't, and the whole business sections don't?
Because they're incentivized not to. And that's not fair on Paul. Paul gets a lot right. But there's a certain worldview that comes with being in the position that you are. And mine is, and one of the reasons that I think that I really understand a lot of what's going on with populism is I come from the same background of those people who are pissed. I don't fit in where I am. I'm an interloper. And someone
the butcher's
from the
boy from Scotland.
Yeah, no, I really am. And what that means is I get it. I get tribalism. I get local identities. right? I get football identities. I grew up with some of the worst ones in the world. I get sort of, you know, the don't try and step out of your zone, right? All the rest of it. These are sort of natural things that people do to protect themselves and the very limited assets that they have. And if you're constantly talked down to by sort of the upper middle class elites who know everything, are so good, and they understand everything, and then basically, you know, you get Afghanistan, you get Iraq, don't worry, it'll pay for itself. You get the global financial crisis, right? You get liberal humanitarian interventionism that gives us the Arab Spring and like a whole new civil war in Syria and a new branch of dictators, all this sort of stuff. These guys have been shown up. They basically aren't any cleverer than anybody else. That's why we don't have faith in them anymore. And I understand why ordinary people kind of get that. The notion that they're all poisoned by Fox News is truly insulting. Look at your own record. Figure out how smart you really are. And then tell everyone they should believe in you. Maybe that explains why it is that people don't, and why it is that we don't have that many politicians coming forward in the mainstream saying, I've got it figured out, this is what you need to do. Because deep down inside, they know they're bullshitting too.
We're waiting for somebody. Who? Or a generation?
I'm waiting for a generation. That's exactly the right word. Look, Bernie is 105 or something like this, right? You know, just as Hillary might run again, he might run again, we'll have a rerun. It's the same old people who own everything, just like refusing to let go. Now, here's the thing that, as I said before, there are more millennials now than there are boomers, but boomers have all the assets and vote twice as much and will vote for asset preservation, which screws everybody else down the line. Millennials need to, and also even beyond millennials, whatever that generation is, they now outnumber these boomers. They need to show up. They need to take control of the Democratic Party. They need to take control. And you see this, actually, you begin to see this in Britain with the Labour Party. They need to take control of the Labour Party. They're the ones that need to set the agenda in terms of their priorities. They need to show up, politicise, argue, get organised, and stop just saying, oh, it's all pointless, or reading online media, which is completely distorted because it triggers your dopamine rush to have your preferences satiated. Right, so think for yourself, get forward, organize, start voting en masse, become the generation that we need, because there's so much that's positive, right? Think about technology. We started with this one, right? Oh, technology is going to destroy all these jobs. Right, I gave you the example of the prosciutto factory, right? Just that's one piece of anecdote, right? 80% of CEOs expect to employ more rather than less people because of AI. When you have economies that are dominated by old people, they save too much, they don't spend enough, the growth rate lags. They all care about inflation, they don't care about growth, they don't care about future investment. So your productivity plunges. This is happening in all the OECD countries. The only way you get your productivity up, because you need that to be richer over time, is if you basically introduce tech. It's just a question of how you do it. Just as nobody in this day and age should be walking up a ladder and moving prosciutto around for 10 years because they'll be on workers' comp for the rest of their lives, there are loads of jobs that we don't need to do that could be doing way more efficiently. And the productivity gains from that can be enormous. The only question is the distorted politics of that. Who gets the returns to robots? What exactly happens with monopoly and concentration? And that's exactly the right issues to be thinking about and fighting about. They're the issues for the millennials to fight on. The boomers don't even understand the issues.
What about the discovery that the digital tools, Google, Facebook, Amazon, all of them are unbelievable monopoly, just insanely profitable monopolies for a very few people?
They've got about 60% margins on them because the marginal cost of producing another digital service is zero. That's it. It's dead easy. Just have to become monopoly player. All they care about is being monopoly players. Peter Thiel said this in his recent book. Basically, the whole point of capitalism is to make money, is to become the monopolist, then you get to print money. That's exactly what they do. So Amazon's on its way to becoming the first $1 trillion company, and then it will get split up. That's what we do. Think about Apple.
We did it with the phone companies.
Yeah,
we did it with
IBM. There's no reason why not. Look, these companies have more data on you than the NSA. How can that possibly be justified? Right? Don't do evil isn't good enough. Particularly when you're making 60% margins and it's going to hardly any people. And you're creating what you basically got now, given the structure of the internet and the way people interact through it, is these are public goods. Therefore, they should be utilities. Therefore, they should be regulated as utilities. And stop using Facebook. It's just rotting your brain.
Now you tell us. Mark Blyth, three cheers.
Always a pleasure.
That's the political economist Mark Blyth at Brown University's Watson Institute in this first week of January 2018. He's an almost addictive habit for a lot of listeners who keep asking for him. On our website, there's an audio file of about a dozen conversations with Mark Blyth. going back to the 08 meltdown, go to radioopensource.org and search for Mark Blythe. His insight and his humor hold up. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our chief bean counter. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.